If you go to the Facebook page for the Sundry, you don't have to look very hard to see how idealistic the business model is. The Sundry, it reads, is a small collective of people with a big dream to build a sustainable American food system. Oh, is that all? Over 4 years and 2 locations, the Sundry tried to take local food to the next level. We'll talk about what that means in a minute, but the Sundry has closed abruptly, and the owner still has questions about what is and isn't possible in local food. That's something he says the sustainable food movement needs to wrestle with. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we'll get started doing just that with the Sundry's Ryan Wing. Ryan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sorry your business didn't work out.
I appreciate that.
What is it you were trying to do that goes beyond the farm-to-table restaurant concept as it already exists here in town?
Well, we were originally intended to be a food business, I'll say. And so the restaurant was intended to be a component of that, but to produce products using the things that farmers here locally produce that could be sold at stores, you know, throughout the metro.
So, like, I guess I'm imagining something I often buy at the grocery store is vegetable broth. And so, like, you would imagine, like, in your vision, there would be a vegetable broth using the vegetables grown by local farmers, that's the product I would buy instead of, like, who knows where they came from.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be a good byproduct, if you will, of the operations of the restaurant and everything else that we were doing, that stock would be produced with both animal bones, but also vegetables as well.
And as long as we're giving, like, examples here, we spoke at one point with someone who worked at the Sundry about local sustainable food in the wintertime. And he was talking about, like, the potential of local trees to be producing syrups other than maple syrup. That's the kind of, like, level you're trying to take it to, where it's not just, like, breakfast has some local sausage and otherwise, like, the pancakes, who knows where the flour came from, the syrup, yeah, it's from Canada, like, taking it to that next stage.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of that just comes down to being aware of what you're eating, being aware of where that came from, how it was produced, and the ramifications of all of those things.
Was 100% local the goal?
We always set the goal of as local as the first option. And so if there was a local option, do that. If there's not, look elsewhere.
So businesses go under for all kinds of reasons, recognizing that the viability of the dream itself probably isn't the only factor. What do you know now that you didn't before about the challenges to anyone trying to do this, what you're up against?
Oh, so much more. I think you have to have at least a little bit of naivete to start a business.
Any business.
Yes, any business. But the assumption that there are enormous problems within our food system was correct, and that those just run far deeper, you know, than I would have imagined before, really being ingrained within it.
Can you give me an example of one problem that runs deeper than you had realized?
So many. But I think one that really becomes magnified is that cheap food is an illusion, and that we produce cheap food, you know, with costs that aren't paid by the consumer themselves. And
how can you give an example of that?
The way we subsidize agriculture and the way we encourage the types of agriculture that we do in America is certainly one, but also there's a lot of exploitation of workers and low wages that happens along the way, and that helps produce a lower price, you know, at
So someone else is paying the price.
But somebody else is paying that price, and that price is a lot of times invisible to the end buyer.
There's so much momentum in local sustainable food as an idea, but is it just the idea we like?
I struggle with that question a lot. I think at this point in time, I tend to agree with you. That it is the, it's the idea that we like, that it, there's something, there's an element of nostalgia, there's an element of, I don't know, good feels, you know, that we get from that.
But, like, I don't live in a pastoral setting, but I do like the idea that someone else does.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that that's where something on my dinner table came from. It's like I got a taste of it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that mental image is what a lot of us conjure up when we eat food. But that is deliberate, because a lot of those hidden costs and those things that we don't like to think about that exist in our food system are purposefully hidden from us, so that we conjure up nice pastoral scenes and not the reality of what it is today.
I mean, is that the reality even when you are talking about local organic food, or is that just like its own reality that people don't want to pay for?
I think the we've really gotten addicted to cheap, you know, and
which there are real pressures.
There are. Yeah. And there are benefits from less expensive food for sure. And that was, you know, one problem that we attempted to address with the Sundry was we didn't want to be a place that was $25 a plate, you know, to go eat at, because that limits the number of people that can enjoy that type of food. And so the goal was always to produce as affordable as possible, you know, simple meals that people could enjoy.
Do you think that portion size maybe became a tool for, like, negotiating that balance?
Yeah, I think almost every eatery in America is negotiating that right now, because food is becoming more expensive, and one way to keep the price the same and, you know, still deliver something to the consumer is give them less of what they're buying. So
this weekend, I went to a farmer's market and I got asparagus from a farm called Herbivore. It cost $5 for the one bunch. That's more than you would pay for conventional asparagus in the grocery store, but it was beautiful and I was excited to use it. That night, I saw a Facebook post from the farm. It's run by a husband and wife team, Dan and Brooke. Brooke explained that Dan had been up since 4 a.m. to start loading up produce for the market I had gone to. And then after a full day at the market, he'd gone back out to harvest more asparagus and then to cover their strawberry plants, since a frost was expected that night. He was dead tired, as you can imagine. It's been more than 12 hours since this day started at this point. But if he had said, you know what, I'm done for the day, that would have cost them thousands of dollars in ruined crops. And I'm not trying to make anyone cry for the poor organic farmers out there. It does put the $5 price tag in perspective, though. The question being, what if $5 for asparagus just isn't realistic for enough people?
Yeah, and I think that's a critical question of whether local slash sustainable food can exist. And I think the solution to that is we have to figure out how to move sustainable agriculture from that Brooke and Dan level, you know, to a larger scale while maintaining the integrity that they farm with. And scale can help reduce price. And until we get there, I think we're, you know, we're at $5 asparagus because of what Brooke and Dan put into that crop.
So if they had like a bigger team producing it, then maybe it would match the effort to price like thing would match better.
Yeah, I think sustainable agriculture, a lot of times can be that pastoral image that we conjure up, but I think we've also got to figure out how to harness technology as a tool to make that a more efficient process and a less burdensome one, so that Dan doesn't have to be up at 4 a.m. You know, the work that our sustainable and organic farmers do at this point is pretty mind-blowing.
Like, the word sustainable might not be the right one for that.
It's absolutely unsustainable for themselves, yeah. And a lot of people get into it and they get out of it quickly because they realize the amount of manual work that goes into it at this point.
In the 4 years you've done this, have you made some breakthroughs in rethinking how we do food, even small ones?
Yeah, I think there's definitely been realizations along the way and confirmations that many of the underlying assumptions that went into what the idea of what the sundry was intended to be were correct. It's mostly how difficult it is to make those things happen.
Problem was confirmed. The solution is still out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you're a small business by itself is hard enough. When you're a small business struggling against a very massive ingrained system, your odds are even smaller.
Do you think you're going to try again?
I don't know what's next, but I do think there's enough problems out there to be solved and businesses exist to solve problems. So I imagine I'll find myself trying to solve one of them.
Ryan Wing, formerly of The Sundry, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next, what is the secret to making new friends? Turns out it is spending time with people. We'll be right back. About a year ago, we talked to a KU professor about making friends. It was a fun conversation, and we're going to listen back to it now.
Let's play a game, all right? Mm-hmm. On the count of three, name your favorite dinosaur. Don't even think about it. Just name it. Ready? One, two, three. Velociraptor.
Making friends takes time, unless you're Brennan and Dale in the movie Step Brothers.
If you were a chick, who's the one guy you would sleep with?
John Stamos.
What? Did we just become best friends?
Yep.
Do you want to go do karate in the garage?
Yep.
That is the movie version. But in real life, making friends is kind of a process, and the strongest friendships are built over time. But how much time? It turns out the answer might be very specific. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard and KU researcher Jeffrey Hall. How many hours does it take to make a friend?
Depends on what level of friendship you're looking for.
Are there, like, levels that are scientifically, specific?
Well, scientifically, based on the research that I did, and the way to think about this is that we all kind of understand that we have friends that are casual friends, people that we know that we would say, this isn't just an acquaintance, but this is a friend. We have friends, of course, that are part of our lives that definitely are an important part of our social life and who we spend time with. But then we also reserve this tiny class of people who we really call close friends or best friends. So to get to the casual friend level, it takes about 40 to 60 hours to have a casual friend. So move from acquaintance to somebody who would call a casual friend.
Well, how do you 80...
Go ahead.
So how do you define casual friend? I want to get these numbers, but I want to make sure we also know what we're talking about.
Yeah. So a casual friend is typically somebody who we have differentiated from a whole group of people who we might interact with in a pleasant way or have a friendly sort of, engagement with. These are people who we might meet at work, in our neighborhood, people from school. These are all people who we kind of know who they are. But to reach kind of a friend level, what people start to think about is this somebody who I actually would want to spend time with by choice? Is this somebody who I want to, you know, spend my social life with? Is it someone whose time with that person alone has value, right? That there's something special about the way we interact or something special about that person and the fact that they like us in return, of course, that makes that spending time with them something special. And I think that at that point, you kind of transition between saying, well, this is just an acquaintance, to this is a person who actually is a friend.
You know, it's interesting that you're using the measure, though, of whether this is someone you want to spend time with rather than you actually do spend time with.
Oh, I think that's a very important distinction. I think about our lives at work. I think that for working adults particularly, they can relate to this. We see some people over and over and over and over again in our jobs spend hundreds of hours together over the course of a year, people who we've become very acquainted with, but we might not elect to spend time with these people. These are not people who we would by choice say, you know what, I want to have this person over to my home to meet my family or to just to hang out with. This is not somebody who might, you know, invite out to drinks or happy hour. These are not people who you might confide in over a cup of coffee about frustrations you're having at work or otherwise, but these are people who are just around. Yet we have a kind of a special classification for the people who we want to have a relationship that's beyond something that we see at work or in our neighborhood. And those are people who are friends.
And so casual friend and friend, those are different too, though?
Yeah, casual friends, when people think about this, these are people who they typically have contact information with. They've seen them before. They've spent time by choice together. There tends to be a friendly relation between the two. Friends tend to have a kind of a more enduring quality in the sense that we imagine them to have kind of characteristics where we would like to continue to keep touch with them, even if we were to not be in their geographic presence or otherwise. So they have kind of a more emotionally close relationship with us. The kind of distinction that I like to think about and others have used is that a friend is somebody who you would answer the question, I really know this person. So if you say, yes, I really know that person, they tend to be more of a friend than a casual friend.
So you have these different distinctions of how long it takes to reach these different levels, but you're pretty focused, it seems, on the casual friend, like reaching at least that stage.
So the idea of the study was that we wanted to see when each one of those cut points happened. So the two studies looked at first adults who had geographically relocated in the last 6 months. So these were working adults in the United States who had moved across the country, usually for a job, sometimes for family, sometimes for other reasons. And they said, is there somebody that you've met since you've moved? And this person couldn't have been somebody who they knew beforehand, who they had romantic interest in, or people who they would be related to. So these were truly people who they had met for the first time since they had moved. Then I asked, how much time do you spend with this person on a typical week? And how much time have you spent with that person last week? And sort of did the math with 355 adults who answered this and said, where was the point at which that transition between some other category, like, you know, workmate or school classmate or acquaintance, transitions to this casual friendship. And so the way that that 40 to 60 hour number comes about is that essentially at this period, this is where the probability or the likelihood of being something closer than just an acquaintance happens. And that percentage gets higher and higher as the number of hours compile.
It's interesting that you disqualified people where there was a romantic interest like that is going to be some different thing.
It is a different thing in a lot of ways. One of the things that makes a big difference about romantic relationship development is that when people spend time looking for partners, for example, online or other places, this actually has a much more scripted sort of protocol about how you move forward. As a person who has studied flirting and courtship before, there's a particular set of steps that you kind of follow through in order to kind of make that relationship happen. And a lot of that involves physical and romantic intimacy. With friendship, it's much more casual, right? I mean, how many times have you met somebody you're friends with and go, are we friends right now? Just like your lead in? Like, that doesn't happen. We don't have this sort of like agreement. We are exclusively being friends, as you might in a romantic relationship.
You don't need to like confirm that that's happened.
Yeah. In fact, we never even mention it, right? You know, knowing that someone might be a friend of yours might be like, in a casual sense, you're saying, I'd like to introduce you to my friend so-and-so. And it actually may be the first time you've even heard that this person regards you as a friend. So what's curious about this is there's no formality to it. One of the people who've been researching friendship for, you know, 30, 40 years, and the thing they point to over and over again is there really is not sort of an agreed on, institutionally sanctioned way to have a friendship, right? It's voluntary. There are no social reasons that you have to keep a friend. You can leave them. You can have as many friends as you want. So there's no real sense that it has that same sort of exclusivity that a romantic relationship partner has, which not only has a script to it, but it has a sort of designation that people say, yes, we are now dating.
Well, so friendship, though, to your point, does feel like something really hard to quantify because not only do you not announce when you're friends, but you don't decide you're friends with someone based on a checklist of criteria. You just kind of know. So is it kind of weird to subject something like that to scientific study?
Well, then it would kind of disqualify some of the most important things in our lives. If other research and people who have done national survey samples, longitudinal studies, have found that having friends and socializing with them regularly predicts longevity, it predicts health, it predicts happiness in your life, having a satisfying life in general. I mean, science has been really concerned with the importance of sociality and our well-being for a long time. The question that I asked is really just to sort of say, how much time do we need to be reserving in our lives to even get to the criteria of having friends around at all?
Oh, that's
interesting. And a lot of that is, yeah, it's an investment. You have to put that time in if you hope to get the benefits from it.
So, I mean, friendship, though, I do understand. I agree just anecdotally in my own life that friendship has real value. But it also seems like one of those things that you do for its own sake when you're doing it well. You aren't
exactly
like, I'm going to go meet a friend because I want to live longer. That would be like the most obnoxious friendship ever.
Yeah, well, exactly. What you just said is some people actually define friendship by the criteria you just set forth, right? There's the people that you voluntarily would spend time with over other people, right? You choose them. And they choose you back, which is a really important characteristic here. You can't just spend time with people who don't want to be with you. That's not going to work either.
Darn it.
Yeah, right? I want you as a friend. You'll be showing up on these hours and we'll be putting the time in. Therefore, we'll become casual friends soon. No, it doesn't work that way. But there is another piece of this that you mentioned I think is important is people actually suss out who they would like to be friends with pretty quickly. I want to give a shout out to colleagues in the psychology department here at the University of Kansas who did a fantastic study that looked at the fact that people actually make a very quick assessment of the similarity between their values and all kinds of other characteristics when they first meet someone. And then they kind of create this niche of people who they want to select their developing friendships from. So this immediate sense, these are people who I want to befriend or become closer to, is something that happens relatively swiftly. However, life constraints come in the way. So you probably, and many people who are out there listening, have had the experience where you meet somebody, you immediately hit it off as a friend. And then what ends up happening is your job, your relationships, you're too busy or otherwise, you never see him again. However, at certain times in our lives, particularly like in college or in high school or other times we have a lot of free time, and sometimes there is some research that says this happens again upon retirement, all of a sudden you have free time to say, well, no, I do want to spend more time with this person. You know, maybe this is a person who I can spend regularly, doing something fun together. And that's the distinction that is so critical, is you have to actually continue to follow through past those immediate feelings of I like you as a friend or
you
I
know,
like you as a potential friend.
It's when you say that, I think about going to college. And one of the things was, you know, we college students were pretty busy. But one of the interesting things was that we all were busy on a very similar schedule, and
yes,
we lived in buildings with each other.
You
and
got it.
I remember at a certain point in my early adulthood being like, why are my friendships now? I mean, I made great friends during that time too, but there was something different. I didn't have like that group of friends that had that kind of that family feeling.
Yes.
And there is something about, you know, proximity and similarity of schedules and being at that same, that it's not just you who needs to have the time, it's that other friend too.
You've got it. So what you're talking about is researchers who have thought about what are the conditions of friendship point to propinquity or proximity and also availability of time as being two of the most critical factors in actually setting the stage for friendship. You have to have these two things present in order for you even to develop friends in general. So if you don't have those things, what becomes very difficult is making time for a longer interaction or routine interaction. And without that, without both people, as you mentioned, being in that state, it's very difficult to do so. But there's another piece of this that I think is important to keep in mind. With young adults and with adolescents, they're going through a time of identity formation where they actually have to figure out who they are. Who am I? What things are important in my life? What are life's big questions that they grapple with? What am I going to do for a career? What should I study? You know, how am I going to deal with these romantic relationships which are intensifying? And you need friends to make you feel connected to a space and a place like college, especially if you've moved away, or to a new town or some sort of new environment. So there's a differentiation of self from your family of origin, and there's a growth of your character and your values, which friends are uniquely qualified to help you figure out for yourself. So you have this internal motivation that's very powerfully moving you towards other people and away from your family of origin, which allows for that sort of identity formation and development of friendship, which is so powerful. And you're by far not alone. Many, many, many people point to that time of their life, either high school or college, as being a time where they created their closest friendships, which they've kept throughout their entire life. So not just during that time, you have time, you have a similar place you're living, right? In a dorm or, you know, apartment building or something like that. But you also have a similar sort of dispositional attitude about the importance of relationships in your life. And these factors together with, of course, the fact that you have thousands and thousands of people in your same space that you could create friends with, such as a place like a college, and all of a sudden it creates this wonderful kind of a place to grow deep, lasting friendship.
And you say retirement does this again?
Yeah. So there's interesting research that says that you kind of have these two periods of life where you grow. Some meta-analyses, which are combining studies from a lot of different sources, have found that it's kind of a winnowing of number of people who you would call friends as you get older. And then there's a slight kind of uptick at the end of towards the end of people's lives or their elderly adults, because they find themselves in a position where they're not obligated by children in their home or perhaps their workplace to spend their social time in those ways. So instead, they tend to find new communities through their church or through clubs or associations or through whatever, and they create new relationships again.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll get right back to this conversation about making friends on KCUR's Central Standard. In just a minute, a former fellow here at KCUR joins the discussion. She was with us last spring when the conversation originally took place, and she has some fascinating insights. More to come. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about the time it takes to make a friend. Not an acquaintance, a friend. Our guest is KU Professor of Communication Studies, Jeffrey Hall. He actually did a study on this, and he says that the answer is 50 hours. That's how long it takes. And Jeffrey, you've mentioned that there are situations in life that make you more available for friendship. Is traveling alone one of those situations?
Yeah, I think it is. And one of the things that happens when you have to move to a new location is you have to kind of figure out what's going on here. Like, who are people who can help me out, make a decision about where to eat or where to live or how to understand folks? So anytime you kind of geographically relocate, you have an openness to creating new relationships. And you tend to focus in those first kind of 9 months after moving as being a really important time to pick up new relationships.
I want to bring Anna Yakutenko into this discussion. She's a reporter with the Kyiv Post in Ukraine, and she's part of a group of international fellows working in newsrooms across the U.S. She's been at KCUR for just a few weeks. And Anna, you tell me you've made a lot of friends really quickly.
Yeah, so that was the case, because I think it's easier to become friends with someone when, like, both of you are kind of out of your usual circle of people and events, and when you're traveling to a completely new country. For me, it's the first time I'm in US, and like all of us, we felt pretty puzzled with everything, because, you know, the small things like how to take a bus and how to pour a Coke at the restaurant. I mean, it's pretty different. So yeah, I would say that, like, we are friends with some of the fellows from my group. Like, we chatting on the phone every evening and just texting constantly, because it's, well, you need those relationships to feel comfortable when you're in the new country.
And with people who are also doing that, like the communicating with people at home wouldn't have that same thing, I guess.
Yeah, sure. Like, you reach people from your home when you want to find out how your country is doing then. But here, there is something in this being in the same situation, being not prepared sometimes for new things. And that really helps you to create these bonds with new people. And that's why I think it's very important to make friends, like, when you actually travel in somewhere, because it really helps you to feel more comfortable and more confident in yourself.
Can you give an example of something that's happened just in the time that you've been in the United States where a new friendship has gotten you through it?
Well, I think it's like one of the cases, it's starting your like new job, my fellowship here at KCUR. And I mean, all the fellows have sort of similar difficulties and the new place, because they need to know, like, found out how everything works, and really to somehow impress their editors and to prove themselves again and again, despite they already have done it so many times in their, like, newsrooms in their countries. So it really helps to keep in touch with those people, because they inspire you to do more. They telling you about their successes, and that's how basically you think, yeah, I will do that as well. Like, this person is so cool, I will do that as well, definitely.
Do you Have you learned anything about making friends through this experience that you think you could apply to just being back home, not being in this sort of special situation?
Well, I don't know. For me, making friends is always kind of similar process. Even here back home, for me, it's more about getting to know people, and also I value being open and honest with each other. So, of course, as previous speaker mentioned, you need to share some common values, and I can see sometimes I can see immediately these kind of values that I share with other person, and then I can decide to make friends with him or her. The same.
Jeffrey Hall, as someone who studied friendship, what do you think of what you're hearing right now?
Yeah, she's saying a lot of things that are very important about contextualizing what, you know, the research would also point out about this. So I like what she was saying about the idea that you're looking for people who can help you understand the circumstances you're in. So the example of the fellows would also apply to perhaps people who are first starting a job on internship, people who were all part of a group of new parents who are taking their kids to kindergarten, a group of people who are all brought into school or some other training situation. And in that new situation, you look around at the people who are commonly sharing the experience, you can go, who among you are people who I want to learn from or understand the situation from? So we'll have some relationship with like mentors or bosses, but those are always have a little more difficulty in developing because there's that status differential. But when people are at that same status and sorting out what they're going to do with their life, it's a key part of our psyche to sort of make sense of our circumstances through the experience of other people.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and Jeffrey is a KU communications professor whose research shows that it takes about 50 hours, that's 50, to make a new friend that would fit in sort of like a casual friend designation. Jeffrey, we have known each other less than 1 hour. That is true of a lot of people I meet on this show. I ask people really intimate questions, though, and I feel like I have a real connection with some of them. But obviously, a public conversation is not even, I mean, I can't become friends with someone that way. But that is most of how I meet people. What am I to do?
Yeah, that's a really good question. One thing that's very difficult about this is figuring out the opportunities we have to disclose in a safe environment, to be able to tell other people things about ourselves where it's socially normative and appropriate. And so although you and I are getting to know each other in some regard on this broadcast right now.
Yeah, I think you're interesting.
Why, thank you very much. I listen to you often, so I feel like I know you a little better than you know me, too.
It's probably a little true.
But part of that is there's a sense when you meet somebody, you're kind of setting the groundwork of what we're comfortable with or what we're willing to talk about. And then you want to repeat those conversations. But what's critical about friendship is that it's not just having had a friendly interaction, but remembering that person and preferring them at another time. So think about this, you know, I might have a lovely conversation now, and maybe there'll be another one in the future, but probably, and I don't want to, it's most likely going to happen that both of us will sort of say, well, that was really nice, but, you know, I just got to go on to my regular life. I'm not going to see you face to face. I'm not going to have time to spend with you.
Yeah, I get it.
It would be very awkward if I said, hey, why don't you come over to my house after this and meet my family? Like, yeah, that would be odd.
I would be weirded out.
Right, because we have a natural sort of progression of intimacy that follows that. And one of the things that I've been studying and thinking about, too, is what do the signals to show somebody you're interested in developing that relationship? And one thing that I think is so important is something that I call a context shift. And this is basically an invitation to spend time with me outside the places in which that we met. So let's say that you and I got to know each other at work and we saw each other regularly. And I said, hey, you want to go get a drink after work and hang out? Or a group of friends from work are all coming out. Why don't you come along? What's interesting is people don't just perceive that invitation as being an important act of, friendliness and otherwise. It's also perceived as a relationship trajectory change. So you would think, well, maybe there's a chance we're going to get to know each other better. And we understand that that's what the person is doing by inviting us into their private space to be together one-on-one.
Does that step have to happen on purpose? I mean, I'm thinking about, do you ever, like, say you and a coworker are both, like, sent on the same work trip. You might spend more time together. And could you become friends as a result of that without either of you having initiated that?
I think you could. And I think that that kind of time one-on-one could provide a new opportunity of growth of friendship. On the other hand, you and I both, I would imagine, could remember circumstances in the past where we've been assigned to work with somebody who, after it's over, like, okay, at least that's done. Let's move on with my life.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Well, let's talk with our listeners. We've got Al on the line from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Al.
Hi. Interesting discussion because, you know, there's something about friendship that sets it apart from other relationships that occurred to me while you were talking is that it's not contractually bound. It's not like marriage or something like that, or even a business contract where you have to get along with someone at a boardroom. It's based on mutual consent. And actually, your producer made a point. It's like in family, you have to forgive each other, kind of, but in friendships, you don't. So it is a very, at least, and this is my experience as well, it's a very delicate relationship that can begin very, you know, casually and easily and could end very quickly. And for, you know, there is nothing really binding it except common agreement. And I wonder if you could discuss that a little bit because it is an unusual contract.
Yeah, Jeffrey, talk about that. And, you know, interestingly, I have known of people to have friend breakups, like
yes.
Formal, like deciding, hey, I can't be your friend anymore.
Yeah, there are two parts to that I'd like to comment on. The first, I think, is really interesting is there's a great book that describes how friendship has existed across time and across culture. It looks at kind of anthropologists' account of friendship in pre-industrial cultures and that kind of thing. And what's interesting is the two characteristics of friendship that happens is one says, I would come to your aid if you needed. And the second is that I prefer you. Like, so these two characteristics of I want to be with you or I prefer you over other people. And if you need my help, I'll be there seem to be the definitional aspect of friendship across cultures. And so what's curious is those are still relationships of choice. There are a handful of cultures throughout the world who have kind of more formalized friendship rituals, but these are actually saved for very tight relationships, something we might like call like a blood brother or something like that, which is not something done in the United States. But there are a handful of places in the world who actually make formal friendship pronouncements. We are friends. So he's absolutely right that the lack of institutional constraints in friendship make it really hard to keep one around, which also leads to another part of my research. In the past, I studied what are called friendship expectations. What do we expect from a friend? And friendships are actually more delicate than our family relationships for the reason that your caller mentioned. So, for example, with a family relationship, even if we haven't seen that person for a long time, we still feel very much obliged to take care of them, to be there for them. You know, the idea that you would abandon your family is very much a culturally across cultures disagreed with. It's seen as taboo. But in the case of friends saying,
of
well,
course,
we've moved on.
It does happen.
It does happen. But there's a pretty strong constraints to not do that. Like, I mean, even if you don't really like them, you're probably supposed to help them out somewhat because they're family, right?
Right.
But with friends, it's sort of like if things didn't work out, no one shames you to say you lost all your friends. Instead, they treat that with sympathy. They're like, oh, yeah, that's really tough. When you move around a lot, you lose your friends. But there's no sense of you failed, right? You're a bad person for not keeping your friendships around, which I think contributes to the difficulty of keeping friends is we have no real sort of strong sanctions against not doing so. So we don't prioritize it. We prioritize all kinds of other relationships instead of our friends.
Is that piece of it true across? I mean, you've said that in other cultures, there are more institutionally binding pieces of friendship in some cultures. But like, does that correlate to longer friendships, more fulfilling friendships?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure of any research that I know of that is able to relate those two things. But that'd be a very interesting study question is to think about whether or not cultures that have stronger sanctions for keeping friends or more formalized institutions are actually more successful in doing so. That's a very good question. I think that in the United States, one of the things that makes it very difficult is we have a heavy focus on ourself and also a heavy culture on working. And I think that self-focused, self-development, you know, individualism kind of things, and then also our focus on working as many hours as we can, both make it very difficult to continue to keep friendships.
There's also, it seems like kind of a taboo against expecting too much of a friend.
Yeah. You're right. And that taboo, one of my favorite episodes of Seinfeld, actually, where he tries to sort out whether or not he's friends with this baseball player he just meets. And the baseball player, I want to say it's Keith Hernandez, but I'm not totally sure. But he actually asks Seinfeld to help him move. And Seinfeld's like, I can't believe we're actually this close of friends. Like, we're not there yet. And so there's a sense that we actually have to casually build up to the possibility of asking a big request, like helping me move or things like that. So there is this sort of sense that our expectations of friendship also match the level of development of our friendship, so that if we have really close friends, if they don't come to our aid in times of stress and dismay, such as relationship problems or you're going through a really tough time and your friend isn't there, that's, you know, equivalent to really violating that friendship contract. But at a casual friendship level, if they don't come to your aid at that time, you don't expect that of them. So we change our expectations of what we want out of a friendship to match kind of the development of closeness and the longevity of that relationship as well.
Let's talk to Mary and Lawrence. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
What can you share?
First of all, I'm enjoying this topic. My husband and I are both recently retired, and about 5 years ago, we were on a trip, about an 8-day trip to Central America. We met a couple that they were also recently retired, and we call each other about every 6 weeks. We Skype each other. We have a bottle of wine and a pizza, and we talk for about 5 hours. We've subsequently gone on several trips also with each other, and it's been just a delight.
Oh my God, retirement sounds awesome.
I'm thinking the same thing.
Okay, so tell me, what do you feel like you've learned about friendship that maybe previous stages of life didn't allow you to see or experience?
Well, one thing is, this couple, he is from Switzerland, she is from Spain. My husband is from England, and I'm from here. And we're all U.S. citizens now. But they all have a wonderful perspective on people and on travel and living in other communities, other countries, and it's just a really fulfilling experience for me personally. And we all are, you know, we're all higher education people. I don't know if that makes any difference, but I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Well, no, Mary, I think you have. I think what's interesting is that it sounds like Mary is learning things from her friends, you know, and is being exposed to new things from her friends. And if we aren't investing the 50 hours per friendship you're saying it generally takes to, like, go from just someone you met and think is interesting to going to, like, this person is my friend, we might never experience that.
Yeah, there's a couple things I would draw attention to. First, I love hearing the joy in Mary's voice and she's describing new friends. It's just a delight to think about that new relationship, people that you can befriend as a couple particularly and keep in touch with and plan future events with. I mean, what a delight to have that in your life. The other thing I like a lot about her story is she said she took, I think, an 8-day cruise when met folks. Think about this. You know, when you're in college and you said, hey, let's go on a road trip. That was not uncommon, right? I mean, I think everybody probably found time for a road trip once or twice in their college years or in that early adulthood. It wasn't a weird thing. But can you imagine for many working adults being like, all right, I'm going to skip out on my family and kids for days at a time to spend time with you, who I think would make a great friend. We're just going to see how that works out. Like, that would be an astonishing...
Yeah, and that's... I'm going to invest those vacation days from work.
With you.
Yeah.
Right. Like, that's an incredible... But what's interesting is both with retirement and that young adulthood, you have that time available. And I would say that, you know, her experience is a really good example of the quick acceleration that can happen when you reserve a lot of time, a long weekend, a cruise together or otherwise, to let that friendship blossom really quickly. And so one thing to keep in mind is these 50 hours by no means have to happen like on a long weekend. But it's also the case that over a very long road trip or a long weekend, you can have this change in the friendship trajectory, like the one that she described.
Jeffrey, you know, what got you interested in researching how long it takes to make a friend? Is this personal for you?
You know, that's a great question. I have always felt really deeply connected with the friends that I've had and grateful for the ones that I've made. And I started out my research on friendship thinking about sex differences in friendship because I found myself to be the kind of person who, amongst male friends, you know, men, don't have tend to have the kind of self-disclosure, the kind of depth of communication that women tend to have. And I always found that kind of interesting. And in studying more and more about how important talk was and what kinds of things you talk about, the more I found myself pondering and thinking more about, well, are there ways to even more nourish quality connections with people and quality friendships over your lifetime? And I've been motivated by that question for a while. And this study that we're talking about right now, one of the things I also find really interesting and certainly part of that theme in my life is that people who said during, about 6 weeks and 9 weeks into the time in which they had met somebody, that they spent time catching up, joking around, having meaningful conversations or expressing affection, sped up their development of friendship faster, even though time still mattered, the types of things they were talking about actually moved that relationship more quickly into a deeper relationship. And these weren't like just self-disclosure activities. These were things like joking around, you know, having fun together. At the same time, people who are actually spending time just talking about small talks or talking about sort of things which are topical discussions tended to actually see kind of a slowing down of their friendship trajectory, which meant that once you kind of stall out and just talk about things which are more mundane, that relationship can't move as quickly as it could. So these things really relate to my sense of how important friendships have been in my own life.
I just want to say you created an online tool that you can use to predict your level of friendship with someone you've met in the last 6 months. And I'm curious under what circumstances a quiz like this would be useful.
So I have I want to give a shout out to my former advisee, Mike Kearney, who is at University of Missouri and Columbia. And he was my advisee and he and I are interested in statistics and kind of statistical probabilities and all kinds of things too. And I was talking to him. I said, what if we created a model from the two studies that I did, the one on adults, which we talked about, and then also one on freshmen, which we didn't have as much time to talk about. Let's take all of that data and basically create an algorithm that would predict, based on the number of hours and a couple short questions, what status of friendship you're in and see how right we are. Because I was thinking to myself, wouldn't it be a blast to basically be like, let's see if we can guess how close you are to somebody. And so he and I are going to work with those data if we get a sufficient amount to see how good these estimates are. Because to be honest, one of the concerns that I have is if those 40 to 60, 80 to, 80 to 100 and over 200 hour estimates are better or worse, I want to make them better so that I can be more confident that what I'm saying to the general public isn't just spurious data, but better based on better science. He and I are going to toy with the statistics on the other side and try to make those numbers even better.
And the general public, again, like, what is it that we are supposed to do with this information?
Oh, man, I wish, if anything, there's a message that I can put out there is in, make it a priority. You know, whatever you need to do to prioritize either yourself or people close to you investing in friendships, do it. So if you're, in a romantic couple, if you're married or you have a long-term relationship partner and you want to encourage them to make friends, encourage them to go out and get to know somebody. Encourage them to invite people they've met to come to your home. Take time out of your schedule to spend time with people and make it. It can be anything. It can be anything that you want to do that's fun together and do that. I would say the other message, the only take-home message that I would have too is, I even in my own life have people who I could become closer friendships with who live in Lawrence, who I've met in the 10 years that I've been here. But I also have to remind myself these things too, is that if I want those people who I consider friends to getting even closer to me as I continue to make my home and my family here, I have to put in that work. So it's almost like a doctor, heal thyself kind of thing.
Yeah, we have time for one more caller. We're going to talk to James in Olathe. James, what do you want to share?
Well, my late father taught me that a true friend is someone who you haven't spoken to in a couple of years, and says that if you can call somebody at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, hey, no questions asked, I need $1,000. And you say, I don't have it, but I'll do my best.
That is very specific, but I take from it, thank you, James, that, this question of what you can ask of someone, and also, what Anna was saying earlier, we were hearing that she's traveling, meeting new people, and that they feel like friends, but 2 years later, will they still be people who, in a moment of questioning or trouble or uncertainty, that's who you reach out to?
Right. And that's the differentiation between types of friends I was talking about. So I think the insight of the caller there and his father would be backed up by the idea that there are only about 12 to 15 people in our lives who we would really be able to make that phone call to. And among them, more likely than not, there are our parents, there are our romantic partner, there are our children. But some of them are our friends. And sometimes our friends have access to resources, to support that are, you know, not anywhere else. So I'd say, let's not wait 2 years before you make that phone call. Make sure you're calling along the way to keep that relationship healthy.
Jeffrey Hall with us from KU. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Go make a friend or reach out to one. This conversation with Jeffrey Hall originally aired last April on KCUR's Central Standard. If you're feeling inspired, you can tweet us your stories and insights about making friends. We'd love to hear what you have to say. We're at KCUR CST. Tomorrow, meet a local singer getting lots of buzz right now. They sing in two different voices, both equally their own. For more on that story, you'll have to tune in tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. The Friendship Show was originally produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.